Hey friends, welcome to this special Chiologician edition of the podcast. Today, I've got a guest interviewer. In fact, I've got two guest interviewers. Really, what I've got is two guests of the show, two people that have been on the podcast, and their mutual interest in how we connect with words, how we connect with spirit, how we connect with each other, got them talking to each other. And they've come together today to share their conversation with us here on Chiological. So I hope that you will enjoy this delightful conversation with Nick Pohl and Margot Rossi. Oh, one little thing I want to make you aware of. At the very beginning of the conversation, a little bit of audio got lost where Nick was asking Margot about the book that she's writing. So keep that in mind when all of a sudden your mind seems to skip and you wonder, wait, what were they talking about? All right, on with the show now.
Hi, my name's Nick Pohl, and I've been a shiatsu practitioner and teacher about 30 years based in the UK. And I'd just like to say a big thank you to Michael for allowing me to interview Margot, and I guess Margot Rossi will also be talking to me a bit in this new idea, just getting people to talk to each other and see what comes of it. Now, Margot, would you like just to say a little hello?
Hello. Hello, Nick. I'm so happy to be here with you. I've been immensely enjoying your book, Words That Touch, How to Ask Questions Your Body Can Answer. It's gorgeous. I'm the last time we spoke, I was on page 47. I think that was like 2 weeks ago. And I've only advanced about 100 more pages because I get so excited about what you've written, and it leads me down different rabbit holes to research. I think it's a book all of us can benefit from, all of us practitioners and patients too. So thank you for writing that.
Okay, Margot. Obviously, being English, I find it really hard to listen to praise like that, but I'll do my best. And just so that people know how this came about, we have both had the great pleasure of having conversation with Michael on Chiological. And as a result of that, Margot contacted me and we started a little online conversation. And then Michael said, why don't you two get together and have a conversation of your own? So.
The impetus for this book came about in 2016. I didn't start writing it until this year. But in 2016, I took a class with my teacher, Jeffrey Yuen. It was another class on Taoyin therapeutic movement, which is a mindful movement. And we'll talk more about what that means. And while I was listening and learning and practicing under his guidance, it just struck me how important this work is. And I know that because I've been using these therapeutic movements in my practice with patients for over 10 years. And it's been an astounding experience to watch people without putting in a needle, without doing a treatment, just offering these movements that require one's attention and seeing what happens from this. Quite profound. So as I was in class doing the movements myself, I thought, well, no one has cataloged these movements yet. I've been studying them for a long time and practicing them myself and teaching them and sharing them with my patients. Maybe I could do that. Maybe I could catalog these movements and talk about many decades of experience of really mindful movement. And this is not an exaggeration, that it really saved my life. So I just thought it could be helpful to other people perhaps to learn about it and to make it accessible to lay people and not just to acupuncturists.
Oh, sure. When you say it really saved your life, is there anything else about that you would care to share with us?
When I was in my early 20s, as many young people, newly graduated from college or just feeling like the world was at their feet, and then feeling like, oh, wait a minute, the world isn't at my feet. I actually don't even know who I am or what I'm doing here. I got a little lost in the world of addictive drugs, and I did that for a few years, and that I came to a crossroads where I thought, okay, I can either keep going in this direction and probably end my life at some point, or I can change what I'm doing. And I chose that path instead of the former. And I sought spiritual guidance through yoga. So that was in the late 80s, and that's what saved my life, really. I really turned my whole life around under the guidance of my yoga teacher back then, and it hasn't, that movement, that flow has not stopped. It's continued through my life, and I've been able to share it with patients and students for a few decades, and it's been very enriching. So
Can I ask, when you say you sought spiritual guidance through yoga, that sounds really important, because I mean, people can go to yoga classes for all kinds of reasons, and yoga, certainly here in the UK, is really popular now and part of the zeitgeist. And you know, you can go to do yoga just to relax a bit after a hard week's work. But were you kind of conscious that you were going there to get this kind of spiritual guidance to save your life, as it were?
Yes. Yeah. I didn't know anything about yoga. I had no idea what it was. I just knew that I was in a dangerous place and I needed to change my life in a drastic way. And that was the only thing. I didn't know about Chinese medicine. I didn't know about, I knew some about East Asian religions. I did study that in school. And so that was kind of the portal that got me to start thinking about yoga. And so I just one day opened up, we had phone books that back then. I opened up the telephone book to the Yellow Pages section and just looked for yoga. And I found someone who was located between home and work, and I just went. Yes, and it was completely for spiritual support and guidance.
Yeah. So that was the 80s, and fast forward now to now, 2018, where you are on an extremely, as far as I can tell, busy practice helping people. And of course, we have this crisis now of addiction. So maybe you could give us an example, a little case study of how you have been using the mindful movement with people who are coming to see you nowadays.
Yeah, I think what I rely on the most, maybe even more than the movement in my practice, particularly with patients who are perhaps trying to come off of opioid medication for pain relief, is simply the practice of attention. So when in the clinic, I'll use breathing as an anchor for the attention. And I know, because you're very well embraced by this concept of mindfulness, that you practice it yourself, that mindfulness is just the ability to.
Sorry to interrupt, but I like that idea of being embraced by mindfulness. It makes me feel a lot more comfortable than thinking I'm embracing mindfulness. So yes, I'm embraced by mindfulness. Thank you very much. Go on, please.
Yeah. And we all are. So just turning our attention to it is a beautiful thing. So I just encourage my patients, you know, when they're on the table, maybe they have some acupuncture points being stimulated at that point through acupuncture.
Yeah.
Maybe they don't. Maybe that's not what they came for. And I just invite them to turn their attention to what they're experiencing right now in the moment. So sometimes that'll be a body scan, just to start at the feet and feel the pressure of their body against the treatment table, and to notice if there are any other sensations that they might feel as they move their attention up through their body, and then ultimately coming to the breath. So just noticing, just like right now, we are breathing, and just to feel where we feel that breath moving most clearly in the body.
Mm.
And
thank you for reminding
me.
Pretty well.
And as we do that, we start to penetrate the mind into the physical body even more through attention. And what most people, and Nick, please speak to this because you use this every day in your practice, most people find that that experience is extremely calming and centering.
Mm-hmm.
And when they allow themselves to experience that, things start to bubble up from the subconscious that have been driving some behaviors or some perception or some experience. And as those subconscious programs come to the surface, you can look at them and recognize what's going on at a deeper level that may be affecting your life, your quality of health and well-being.
Yeah.
And then you can start to change it, to shift it.
Sure. And you were also talking about attention as a way of living from that inner nature into a sense of the Wu Wei, the effortless being.
Yeah.
And that seems, yes, to be what you're suggesting you can do here with the bringing attention to the body and the breath. Yeah, is there anything more about that?
Well, I think just coming to know yourself more clearly, you can see what thoughts and beliefs are operating under the surface that drive actions and behaviors. You can come to know yourself more clearly through that. And as you come to know yourself, you can realize that you have the ultimate power to change your life if that's what you choose to do.
Hmm.
And so one of the beauties, you know, as I'm actually working what you have so beautifully laid out in the Words That Touch book, working those clean questions in clinic, they, you know, plumbing the depths that way and just allowing the people, yourself or your patients, whomever you're using these with, to investigate a little deeper. What am I feeling? And is there anything else about that?
Yeah.
It allows things to bubble up that you come to know yourself more deeply. You get to see maybe, gosh, this is how I am expressing myself in the world right now, but I can see that truly deep down, this is who I am. And then you start to change those behaviors. It's profound medicine.
I think I that resonates a lot for me because what I really love to do is to use some kind of therapeutic dialogue, you call it. I mean, clean language is the brand that I like to use that I wrote a book about. But also, you're using acupuncture or movement. I'm using shiatsu. Also, allowing people to get into that state of just not really being governed anymore by the conscious verbal mind, in which, as you say, things can bubble up from the body, from the heart, from the unconscious, whatever terms we use. And these insights seem to be, you know, it's come from a deeper place sometimes than if you're just using a talking therapy, or indeed if you're just using a body energy therapy. It's like the combination between the two causes something sometimes magical to happen. And in terms of the research I did for my book, it kind of comes down to this linking between the two sides of the brain, the very verbal left hemisphere, which tends to see the body as a kind of a collection of parts, a mechanical assembly of things which can go wrong and need to be fixed. And the right hemisphere on the other hand, which exactly reflects the crossover between hemispheres,
right,
body movement functions. Right hemisphere is much more intimately and sophisticatedly connected with the body, and this kind of felt sense and the imagery and metaphors that can arise from that embodied sense of being. But at the same time, it doesn't actually have words. So I think when we're working in the way you're talking about, we're inviting these two sides of ourselves to meet each other. And that meeting is the magic, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think another part of that that's so cool, well, and there are many, which I hope we circle back to in our conversation, is that, you know, the acupoints themselves, so whether you're using acupressure, acupuncture, or even just your attention, like using a sort of a qigong approach to the points,
yeah,
that those points are, at least in Ayurvedic medicine, and I know I'm sure in Chinese medicine too, those points are actually where our consciousness is embodied in our body and different aspects of our consciousness. So it's almost like the points are where the mind is, where we can access mind and body
together
through that felt, yeah, sense of intention or touch or a needle. It's, to me, it's just fascinating how these ancient traditions of medicine recognized that the mind and the body are the same thing. And you can affect either one, mind or body, through the other.
Yes. So do you have an example of, say, a particular point that you've recently felt that kind of information coming through with a particular patient?
Oh, I think what I've been using, because it's the time of metal now in the autumn, I've been responding to many of my patients having some kind of respiratory thing come up right now in this season. And so in order to help the lungs diffuse, so this is a very, you know, this is a very clinical way of thinking about the point or the channels. Coming to the lung channel and using the point lung 7 to help the lungs diffuse the lung qi. So when you put a needle in that point, it is like it's what the name of that point describes, lightning strike. And it can feel like a little electrical shock to people. Maybe you can, I mean, even with acupressure, you can get that going on that point. So yes, I've been using that in the clinic, and remarkably, when that point goes in and people's attention gets drawn there because the sensation can be so startling and unusual and unanticipated and difficult to understand what that feeling was, they feel the feeling. And it's as if their mind opens up for a moment. So yesterday I had somebody in the clinic who had a cold, and I chose that point. And we were talking about coming to understand how our body responds to changes in the environment, so that she could get an awareness of perhaps how she came to get this illness. And then in the future, she could learn from her experience if we brought a little more awareness to it. And when I put the needle in, she realized that, she just said out loud, "Oh, I have been really busy. I didn't even realize how busy I've been. And I've been going in and out of the house a lot, sometimes not bothering to put something on my body."
Mm.
So, you know, that's a really simple, it's nothing about enlightenment or learning about one's inner virtue, but it is about understanding how one's behavior and one's environment can affect one's health and well-being.
And it's about having a sort of sudden little insight, because when you went into a point, suddenly the mind realizes something about a behavior, which is fascinating.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
So just sort of for people who are listening, maybe acupuncturists or maybe shiatsu people or maybe qigong teachers, the practical question, of course, is, well, is this okay, and does it take more time, and what kind of questions am I supposed to ask here, and is it going to bring up more stuff than I I feel I have time to deal with, or I feel comfortable or experienced enough to deal with. And I know you've taught NLP in acupuncture training and so on. I just wondered how you address those kind of very common, very practical, very understandable questions.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, I know you can answer this question too quite well, but I'll speak to it from my point of view. In terms of taking more time, no, I don't think it really takes more time. It takes more attention and presence on behalf of the practitioner, which is also the gift of what we're doing. It's a gift for ourselves to be centered in the moment and paying attention. So it doesn't take more time. And as you're going through the interview process with someone, whether it's an hour-long interview where you're doing a first, you know, initial visit using the 10 questions or whatever manner in which you interview people, or if it's just a 10-minute check-in or 5 minutes, through the practice of neuro-linguistic programming, we learn about how we can use body language and verbal language as ways of building rapport with our patient. And those just come naturally. They're not add-ons. They're just part of how you are present in that moment with that person asking those questions. And that as you gain rapport, just through your body language and your words, as you're responding to that person and they feel more comfortable with you, then again, things from the subconscious are more apt to bubble up to the surface so that your diagnosis can be clearer and your treatment can be more appropriate for them, more effective perhaps.
Yeah.
And then as I haven't gotten, you know, very far in your book, but where I think I was reaching into, you have a beautiful discussion in your book about, you know, as you're asking these questions and you're tapping into the subconscious, having the wisdom to know how much to continue to go forward in those questions. And when is it that the patient begins to perhaps get fearful about what they're discovering, or they no longer want to go with you into those questions? You know, being able to read that and respond to that.
Yeah.
That takes, you know, some practice and experience. And
I think that comes back to what you just said earlier about how you are present with that person in that moment.
Yeah.
As soon as we start losing that kind of presence and start thinking about what should my diagnosis be, and or right. do I have enough yeah. training and counseling to stay with this stuff, then we stop being so present. And and that brings me back to the themes of your book in a way, because when you're showing somebody some kind of mindful movement or bringing attention to their body, the way you do it, the way you are present with them, is really important, a really important part of that. And also, yeah, just curious if there's more about that sense of how you're present as you're maybe showing people some qigong, or because the body is talking back to you. In my experience, when I'm showing somebody a piece of movement that they could be using, or which their body has already unconsciously started to do, and you know, and I'm pointing it out to them, it's my awareness and my sense of being present with them as they do that, and maybe also reflecting it back, mirroring it back in my own
yes.
movement. Yes, are you sort of talking about that in your book?
Yes, so that's one of the principles, the main principles of water. So as you mentioned, the title of my book is To Be Like Water. I chose that partly because the metaphor of water is something that we can all relate to. So it's very simple. It's a lot simpler than relating to mindfulness, perhaps, that word. So water is used throughout the classical texts of Chinese medicine as a representation of one's presence. So We know that water can flow. It can penetrate into places where nothing else can go. It can penetrate into places, if we're going to anthropomorphize it, where we might not want to go, where others might not want to go because it's scary or unappealing. Water's also soft and yielding, and yet it can erode and transmute very hard substances. And finally, water, when it is calm, things can settle out of it, and it becomes very clear and placid. It becomes reflective so that we can see ourselves in it. And it becomes profoundly deep. And in the Chinese also say it can become invisible. Mm. So if you think of being a practitioner and you're embodying those qualities, that you can go where other things don't want to go. So you can be present to that other person. And in your own stillness, they can see themselves. And that just opens the way for this, whatever therapy you're bringing to your practice, doesn't matter what it is, it allows an opening where you can really start to speak to the mind, and the mind can, and then that person can begin to change their mind, which will in turn change their body.
So as you were saying all that, it was kind of like a hypnotic induction. I was feeling all these different qualities of water, and when you got to still and deep and invisible, I was really right in there and experiencing, literally experiencing my sense of myself in a different way, which I guess shows us the power of language, because this is, after all,
yes,
just a metaphor. And yet we know actually that metaphors are the most powerful way that we have of communicating with each other, and politicians are using metaphors all the time, but they're also the most powerful way, it seems, that our body mind, our unconscious, finds as a way of communicating with the conscious verbal everyday mind. It's through metaphor that it really starts to happen.
I was just going to say, you have a beautiful chapter in your book on the power of metaphor, so thank you for that.
Well, yes, that study of metaphor is certainly at the heart of the clean language approach. And it's not original to clean language, because there's a lot that came before that in cognitive linguistics and so on how important metaphor is in the way we communicate. But the way you were talking there, the way I was feeling affected by it, these things, again, they do perhaps take a little training, a little confidence. And I'm just curious about, say, when you were teaching your acupuncture students these kind of skills, rapport skills, how did people find that it helped in their practice?
Well, I snuck those into class.
Yeah.
So I didn't get a whole lot of feedback from students, you know, for more than one semester. So I can't really speak to how that's played out in their lives as clinicians. But I can tell you, and I'm sure you can speak to this too, there arises immediately the question of manipulation. Mm. when you have those skills of knowing how to mirror or match someone's body language, or to pay attention to the words they use if they're more visual or auditory or kinesthetic, a vocabulary. And then, like you say, to kind of reflect that back to them. Mm-hmm. And how that builds rapport. So at first there was a kind of a distrust and some misgivings about consciously being that conscious in your practice with another person. But as the students practice the skills, they definitely connect into an internal felt sense of how they become more relaxed, which of course, you know, as beginning clinicians, it can be pretty frightening to sit in a room with someone asking intimate questions and then knowing that that person's looking to you for assistance.
Yeah.
So these skills are so helpful for the practitioner to be present, you know, and not to be carried away on that stream of fear or worry, just to be present in the moment. And that is so comforting to our patients too, because we all just want to be present with someone. We want someone to be there with us. They don't have to say anything or do anything, but just knowing someone is there is huge. So
yeah,
the students did find the value of it. And, you know, some of them gravitated more to shifting their body language, or some of them liked more the verbal connection. I hope they're all practicing it.
Well, it reminds me of one of the most inspiring things I heard of recently, which was you mentioned reading Ted Kapchuk's seminal book, The Web That Has No Weaver, early in your encounters with Chinese medicine, and the fact that he has had this amazing career change, that he's now a professor of placebo studies, I think, and the therapeutic relationship at Harvard Medical School. He could have gone on just being a, you know, world-renowned, distinguished acupuncturist to the end of his days, but he saw this challenge. I think he must have realized that placebo studies are the way that we can get through to the medical mind. And they're now doing these very sophisticated studies, psychological studies about, and double-blind kind of studies about what aspects of the therapeutic relationship have a more placebo effect than others, and so on. What, in other words, changing the way that the medical people think about placebo. To now, I think placebo has been thought of as a kind of black box, and okay, we don't go there. We just recognize it's a thing. But now that they're doing this kind of work at such a high level in such a respected place as Harvard Medical School, doctors are beginning to think that this mind-body connection is itself a healing thing, and not just an awkward bit that you have to get it around when you're doing a double-blind clinical trial. So, yeah. And that leads me to a quote that you came up with when we were thinking about this conversation. In NLP, we talk about getting rapport as if it's a thing that you get because you have some skills. And yes, indeed, that can be very manipulative. And there's a whole school of sales training, which is about, you know, getting rapport and so on. But
It's
through that rapport, and this is very much comes from the work of a brilliant psychoanalytical psychotherapist based in California called Alan Shore, who's making a huge impact on the way psychotherapists think about being with their clients. That as we're having a mind-to-mind verbal conversation about whatever the issues may be, our bodies are having a body-to-body conversation as well.
Yes.
But we don't notice it. We don't pay attention to it. And there's so much information there through that can come through your body as the practitioner. And that is what moves us from rapport to relationship. And that's why I think it's so important to talk to my colleagues in the shiatsu world and the body energy world about using language, because it's this relational aspect, which at the heart of it is what Chinese medicine is all about. And this quote, maybe you could just, if you have it there with you, run it by us, from the Neijing, about conducting one's life. That, what was it? Yes, one's life is conducted by one's spirit. If you could just tell us a little more about how that resonates for you.
I actually read that in an article in the early 1990s. It was through an interview with Per Lahr and Elizabeth Rochat de la Vallée. I don't even remember what it was, in the Journal of Traditional Acupuncture, again, back in the 90s. And there was the essence of what they were talking about in one section of that examination of the Neijing was that the spirit will move when the environment is conducive to it moving. So that just struck me in, you know, way back when, in my early studies of Chinese medicine, that you can do whatever you want to do with, your acupuncture needles or your, you know, application of essential oils or your acupressure. But if the environment that you've created isn't conducive to the person's spirit to move and shift, your treatment won't land. It won't really have an effect. Or maybe it'll have a temporary effect, or perhaps it'll just land on the physical, but it won't really move the, it won't move the spirit. And without moving the spirit, well-being won't be restored. So that's kind of, I hope my logic is appropriate there. So that just spoke to me like, oh, wait a minute. Who I am in the treatment room, how I create the space in my treatment room to invite the person in so that they feel that they can calm and center themselves, so that they can feel that it's safe and okay for them to explore and realize perhaps something, a deeper operating system, so they can change it. That was paramount in my clinical practice. And that's so true. Like even in my movement classes, whether they're yoga or Tao Yin classes, that awareness of how important my own presence is in the room, or clearing the room with some incense before people enter it, or using the sound of a bell to clear the space, or just sweeping the floor.
Yeah.
is a lovely way to offer a place, a safe place, that's conducive for the spirit to move.
Yes, so that aspect of the environment, the space, the room, the windows and the doors and smell and everything about it, the clearing of the space in a feng shui way, I suppose, is really important.
Yes.
And I've been noticing that more myself lately. But also you were mentioning in that same quote, it says, the well-rooted presence and virtue of the practitioner are key to this environment. In other words, you're kind of like the conductor. The environment, the space, the room is maybe the orchestra, and you are the conductor of that orchestra. And your internal environment, what your body is telling you, are just as important.
Yes. And that... you just reminded me of Per Lars' analogy of the birds come to the tree, not the other way around. So I like to think of it as if you present the water to the horse in such a way that it beckons the horse to come, the horse will probably drink from that well, from that spring. So yeah, the importance of the environment to call in the spirit.
Yes, that's a very great down-to-earth saying that we have. You can take a horse to water, but you can't make it drink, as a way of thinking about the Nei Jing quote, that one's life is conducted by one's spirit, and a treatment has to move the spirit to restore well-being. The spirit is the conductor of the chariot of life, moving everything according to the Tao. And how we connect, how we bring in, how we make the space and ourselves appropriate for that spirit to say, this person's making a bit of a mess of their life, but I think I'll come in, as opposed to not coming in. This seems to be the whole question. And earlier on you were talking about doing less and less and using more and more attention, inviting the patient to use more and more of their own attention as you do less and less of your expert practitioner skills, as it were. That seems to me the way that we invite the spirit in.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's beautiful. I dig what Ted Kapchuk has done. I think I wrote to a friend of mine. I can't remember who, but maybe I wrote to you. I'm not sure who it was, but I wrote after getting to page 155 in your book, I thought, you know what? I think I can put my needles down and just be present and invite through these questions. because it has been amazing in practice. What little I have learned, because I've only gotten so far in your book, but what little I've learned through the book and put into practice has been, it has been so exciting in my treatment room.
Yes, you did write.
It's been great.
You did write to me about that, Margot, and I remember responding that it's not just the clean language, it's you, because I, you know, I've trained a lot of people in this, and it takes a really experienced practitioner who has the same kind of values and interests that you do to get those kind of results so quickly just from reading a book. I think that, I mean, I'm hoping, not that I've read a word of it yet, but I'm hoping that your book conveys some of that essence of who you are when you are with your patients. I remember you saying that there's a sense of love, a sense that you love the sense of the we of the two of you. And I think I'm not as far down the road as you in that respect. Sometimes there's a sense of meltingness or compassion, and sometimes there's not. But there's this, you were saying that your book is going to be made up of essays. And is there an essay that comes to mind in respect of this sort of real sense of connection with the person you're working with?
Oh, goodness. Yeah. So the essays are, some of them are based on my own personal experience of mindful movement or mindful attention and movement. And some of the essays are based on my experience with patients in the clinic or my experience as an instructor in the classroom, a movement instructor. So yeah, I'm sharing that metaphor of water and attention and movement through these short essays. In terms of anyone in particular, no, because they're, I think every single essay, some of them venture more into theory, but I do weave them together. I do weave together the water and the attention and the movement and what I see in myself or my patients or my students. So I hope I think it'll be a really enticing journey for readers, whether they're practitioners or not. I really want the book to speak to anyone, regardless of what their experience of Chinese medicine is. And the second half of the book is I'm sharing the Taoyuan therapeutic exercises that I've learned from Jeffrey Yuan over the past couple of decades. And that section just welcomes readers into a direct experience of the movements and the attention, and then they can see the therapeutic results from that. What's I love about the Taoyuan exercises, if you look at the characters for Taoyuan, they depict a bow that's being stretched, you know, like a bow and arrow. They depict a head and an eye, and the radical for measurement. So the movements are all about moving in a certain way, noticing what you feel and experience and see about yourself, kind of measuring how you move through life. Where do you find obstacles? Where do you find freedom? And in that practice, I mean, not only is it extremely relaxing, but it is revelatory. I mean, people at the end of class, I had a student in my spring class who really was sort of a surly kind of curmudgeon person in our community. And you could just see her face starting to shift and soften, you know, every time we had a class meeting. And by the third class, she said, I've gone to all kinds of movement classes. I've never kept going with them. I've given up on them. But this one, something's really different about this one.
And do you have an idea of what was different, what the difference was for her?
Yeah, I think she felt embraced by the space. First of all, it was in a beautiful room of our library, our old, you know, just a beautiful old building. But secondly, I think just the intention of the movement kind of seeped in and permeated into her that ability that I can pay attention to myself. I can learn more about myself. I'm in a really safe place in an atmosphere of love and acceptance. That's what I think really moved her way more than the movements. The movements, this Taoyuan practice is all lying down, so it affects the metal element. Yeah. And it's kind of the first position we take in life. You know, when we're babies, we're just lying down. We can't really do anything else but lay on our backs or our tummies. So it's sort of the first move brings us back to our origin as postnatal beings. And the movements are all very gentle. You don't really stretch. You just kind of move into the space that's available in your body. And when you start to feel a sensation, you just notice it. Okay, there's my boundary. And then that's the point at which you pause. So you don't really go. It's not like a lot of yoga where you're really moving a little deeper into the stretch. It's not about that. So because the body can be comfortable, the mind doesn't have to be distracted, and it can really kind of dive into, gosh, what am I feeling? What do I see about myself here as I move? Yeah. That's an amazing practice, and anyone can do it. If you can get on the floor and lie down, you can do it.
And so the whole of the second part of your book helps people to explore this Taoyuan approach.
Yes. Yeah. So there'll be photographs of the actual positions and the movements, and then detailed description of how to do them.
You know what it reminds me of is the Feldenkrais work, which I absolutely love. I go to a class every week and sometimes have one-to-one sessions too. And the fascinating thing about Feldenkrais, who you know, he structured it in exactly the same way. It's nearly all lying down. So you're right back into that, as you say, postnatal sense. And absolutely crucial all the way through is never to push, never to force anything to happen, to respect that moment, that become more and more sensitive to the little glitches that begin to appear when you really slow down. And of course, Feldenkrais was very interested in East Asian martial arts, and he was one of the first people to bring judo to Europe, I think, as well as all the other extraordinary things he was good at, a real polymath. But it just reminded me so much when you said that, and it's just so good to hear the way you describe it, the sort of the deep Chinese roots of that approach, because I think nowadays a lot of the stuff we see about East Asian martial arts and so on, it all looks terribly strenuous, terribly energetic, very Shaolin temple. And it's tough. And I deeply respect that stuff. That comes more, you know, with the warrior archetype. But what we're talking about here is ultimately, however we do it in our relationship with our own bodies as practitioners, encouraging a friendlier sense of relationship for the patient with their own body and mind. And seeing how that works for them, it sounds like the way you're doing that with the movement and the Taoyuan is really perfect.
Yeah, you asked about that one participant in the Taoyuan class this spring, you know, what I thought helped to soften her. And I think, you know, the movements, when you allow yourself just to experience what's happening in the moment, and it's okay. There's no judgment necessary. You just observe it. That creates a sense of compassion inside oneself. And of course, the more compassionate you feel, it kind of loosens the knot that you can change your behavior. You can change your perceptions. You can change how you think about things. You might change some beliefs you have. And that compassion acts like water. It's soft and yielding, but it can really change something, and it can change structure. So you see the effects on the personality, you see the effects on the energy level, and you can also see the changes in the body too. And really, it's just through this compassion, and it acts like water in the sense that it creates a ripple effect and it moves through us and helps connect us to our true selves. And it also helps us connect us to each other. So that's another beautiful thing about being like water. Mm. If you think about rain dropping down to the earth and then it meeting other raindrops and how that flow just keeps getting bigger and bigger, you know, streams, creeks into the river, and then tributaries of the river meeting to join greater rivers, and then that flowing into the ocean. These little drops of compassion for oneself ultimately spread out to everyone. And, you know, in a classroom of movement, especially at the end of class at Daoyin, I feel so full of love. And I feel it in the room, and the students feel it in the room. And it's beautiful to see the stress that came in on the face is gone, and there's a smile lighting up the person. And I just know, like, I'm Italian, so it's like they just had a really good meal that was cooked by someone who loved cooking for them.
Ah, that's it. So, I think we've got it now. As I've been listening to all this, Margot, I've just been thinking, oh, now I'm beginning to get a sense of what it is that Margot really does. And and it's not just being Italian or Italian-American or whatever, but you use that word embrace again a little while ago, but about that person in your class feeling embraced by the space. And I'm just so interested, this metaphor of water, which is so powerful and so important for you. And it reminds me of, we were discussing this in the mindfulness group that I run here in London recently, about you can't force this thing, the spirit being willing to come in and reconnect with the person. You can't force it.
Yeah.
But the same, I remember Shakespeare uses the same water metaphor when he's talking about compassion, or in mercy, you know, it's what he uses in The Merchant of Venice, that when he says the quality of mercy is not strained, in other words, not forced, it droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven. So here we are right back in your metaphor of these drops of compassion acting like water, soft and yielding, and creating a ripple effect and moving through us and connecting us to each other. I think it's absolutely beautiful and fascinating, and also maybe a little challenging to people who are thinking in a rigidly five element way. How can water be compassion? I thought that was like more like the fire element, but I was just wondering how you find this water metaphor interacts with patients who maybe are very stuck in a wood pathology, or very much in a fire pathology, you know. And being, you know, sort of being aware that it's such a powerful metaphor for you, and how do you work that if it may not be the metaphor that sounds right for the other person?
Mm. Well, I have one great advantage. Where I live, we live by one of the cleanest rivers certainly in the state of North Carolina. I'm sure it's on the top 10 in the U.S. It's a gorgeous river, and my office is, I don't know, 100 yards from the river. It's not very far. So we can hear it in the office, and I will often point to it when I'm speaking about water. And because of where I live, because of this environment where I live, it's very easy for me to share the metaphor of water and point toward the river and people to understand what I'm talking about. So it translates because of where we all are located.
Sounds like it does more than translates, it transforms the environment.
Yes, it transforms.
And that hypnotherapy, basic hypnotherapy principle of as soon as you allow a person to start listening and let things be more quiet, they begin to hear the background sounds. And if the background sounds the flow of running water, you're right back there with the I Ching, and it's all happening.
Yes. Yeah, and if you don't live near a river, then you can put a little bubbling fountain in your office and refer to that so that people can connect to the water. I love going down to the river with my friends, and it doesn't matter what kind of person they are. They're, you know, large intestine person or wood person, or one of my closest friends is absolutely squarely in the Palace of Fire. And when we go down to the river together, we'll stay there for 3 hours just looking into the water, maybe picking up stones, maybe looking at little critters in the water, but mostly just looking at the water. And we both love it. I'm pretty fiery myself, so I like that. Yeah, I haven't really found any obstacle in my practice regarding that metaphor of water. It just takes care of itself. Like I said, it goes wherever other things can't or don't want to go. And I think you can really trust it to, that metaphor just works. The only time it's been maybe problematic, and I learned this early on when I used to use it, is that if someone has a fear of water or has had an experience of being unsafe in the water, nearly drowning or being pulled under, you do have to tread a little carefully with that. But if you use the rain in the metaphor rather than the ocean, that works. That can work for them.
Indeed. And water being such a flexible element, you'll always find some way to connect, to respect and work with that fear, which after all is the emotion that comes with the water element.
Yeah, you can just use vapor, the water vapor, if the more condensed version doesn't work for yourself or your patient.
Or remind your patient that they are themselves 70 to 80% water.
Yeah, and that chi,
you can't get away from
chi is a vapor. So,
yeah,
exactly.
Okay. Well, Margot, that seems a lovely place for us to wrap up this beautiful conversation. I've really learned a lot. My aim really was to find out more about how you do what you do and how you be who you are in this therapeutic relationship. And I think what I've really learned is that you have some beautiful way of balancing fire and water. And I guess I better start looking for my Italian antecedents.
Yeah, I think this kind of circles us back to the beginning of the conversation where you asked me how I came to this place. And I was telling you that, you know, when I was younger, the path that I was choosing for many years was through drugs. And talk about my fire being out of control. I was living a high-fired life. So I have really found refuge and solace and support, and I found myself in the water. It's been a blessed journey.
Yeah. And I think that's it, that these two polarities, elemental polarities, fire, water, and me in a sort of Buddhist Zen-like cosmology, I think of it as compassion on the one hand and emptiness on the other. And if I can get the balance right between those two things and the way I can be present with any particular person, then I'm, at least the ball will start rolling.
Oh, yes. And when we meet ourselves, we meet everyone else. So it's such a beautiful gift, and the world needs us. The world needs each of us to meet ourselves so we can meet each other. There's a beautiful, I'm not going to get it right, but I'm going to do my best. Amma, who is, I think she's named the hugging saint. She says something like, the sun shines down on 1,000 pots filled with water, each pot is different, but reflects the same sun in the same way as each of us is different from each other. We are like that water in those pots, and we reflect the same source of life and love. So we're all the same, just different vessels. Amen to that water. If it can help us.
Amen. And I really look forward to your book becoming a reality.
Thank you, Nick.
And I wish you all the best with it, because I know how, well, I know how hard it was for me to get through that. And I know you've got some good help there. And I think anyone who writes a book needs some kind of help or coaching or mentoring. Anyway, and huge thanks to Michael for putting this, making this a possible, of making this possible.
Yeah, and for introducing us.
Yes, and is there anything else you wanted to say just to round off, Margot?
No, I just want to once again thank you for your book. And you have put in a tremendous amount of information, research, passion into Words That Touch. And I am sharing it with my patients, and other practitioners that I know will appreciate it. So thank you for doing that. And as I'm in the process of writing a book, I see how what tremendous amount of energy, focus, intention it takes. And I just want to thank you, Nick. It's a lovely gift to us.
Okay, that's great to hear. Again, thank you, Margot. And to anyone out there, if you have been listening, thank you very much. And maybe we can meet again.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think we have many more conversations yet to come.